You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You are tuned in to another edition of Americana Music Profiles, brought to you by Americana Rhythm Music Magazine and AmericanaMusicMagazine.com. I'm your host, Greg Tutwiler. Let's jump right in to the next exciting interview. Tom Jutz is a German-born Nashville songwriter who's taken advantage of the current situation to release not one, but two projects this fall. To Live in Two Worlds, Volume 1, came out earlier this summer, and To Live in Two Worlds, Volume 2, released in late September. Tom joins me in this edition of Americana Music Profiles to talk about his latest release and his musical journey. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the podcast this afternoon.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yes, sir. Thanks for getting on with us, and appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about your new music. It's certainly strange times to be trying to get that out there, but I'm sure you've had extra time, more than normal, putting stuff together.
Well, you know, yes and no. You know, this is Volume 2 of To Live in Two Worlds, and Volume 1 came out in May. So I had a tour of Ireland lined up in March, where I was going to start promoting this record, and then about 30 other shows and radio interviews and stuff like that, and it all got canceled, but... So Volume 1 that came out in May gave me a little bit of, gave me some good rehearsal time to put out Volume 2 in this vacuum of sorts. And, you know, you just have to rethink your approach a little bit, and it works pretty well, actually, you know.
Was it always a two-volume plan?
Yes, it was. It was from the beginning. It was intended to be exactly like that. So the reason it happened was last May when I made those two records, the first record was a record with the whole band, and then the second one was just a solo record, me singing and playing at the same time.
Right. Okay.
And when the label and I looked at those 28 songs, we had the idea that it might be cool to pair them, a band song followed by a solo song that sort of that connects thematically. And we tried to sequence it like that and really liked the result. And instead of putting the band record in the solo record, we decided let's mix it and put out a Volume 1 and a Volume 2.
Okay, awesome. If we can, I'd like to dial backwards a little bit. You are a songwriter by trade, right? Was that your profession before you began putting out some of your own recorded material?
Yes and no. I moved to Nashville primarily as a guitar player 20 years ago, and
okay.
I toured with Mary Gaucher for 3 years, and with Nancy Griffith for 5 years, and toured some with Maura O'Connell and Kim Ritchie and people like that. And I had always written songs since I was 15 years old, but I only got serious about it once I got to Nashville 20 years ago. And I always been co-writing a lot, and mainly with the focus of getting songs cut in the bluegrass world or in the world of country music.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple of years ago, I just figured that I had so much material that was much better suited for myself than other artists.
Yeah,
that,
okay.
That I just started putting out my own records.
What got you excited about songwriting as a young person in the beginning? You're originally from Germany, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I was born in Germany, and I moved here when I was a little over 30 years old, but I had been coming to the United States a lot in my 20s. My wife had lived in the States as a child, and she always wanted to move back. And so But I knew that I wanted to move to Nashville when I was 11 years old and saw Bobby Bear on a German television, country music television show. And that sort of was a life changer for me. And I just did the research and got more interested into the music and went further back into the music and got interested in bluegrass and acoustic music. And as soon as I could make the move, I made the move, and I'm very happy that I did. But the moment when I did, well, I think like a lot of songwriters, I started writing when I was in, you know, in my teens, because I was in a band and we needed original songs.
Okay.
So somebody who could do it had to do it.
Yeah, right.
So that was me. But then I think what really got me into it, when I got really heavily into the whole Texas singer-songwriter scene, Guy Clark and Tom Van Zandt, and I became really good friends with a gentleman called Richard Dobson, who was a part of that of that crowd that came to Nashville in the early 70s from Texas. And actually, we became really good friends and toured together and recorded together quite a bit. And so that really got me hooked on the world of songwriting and being here in Nashville. And I started working with some really great songwriters like Pat Alger and Tony Arata as a guitar player or as a producer. And so I toured with David Olney for a while. So, you know, a lot of people where you can, if you want to learn something about songwriting, you can if you keep your ears open. And that's what I try to do. Same goes for Mary Gauthier and Nancy Griffith. So I was around a lot of great songwriters for a long time. Or I have been, I still am. And it's just, that's the school you go to, I assume, you know, because there's no official school to go to.
Right. And I was going to ask you that if you had, because some people go to East Tennessee State University. Of course, now probably it wasn't an option, you know, 30 years ago, but, you know, there are training, if that's the right word, tracks that you can take. But I wondered if that had been part of, or anything like that had been part of your journey.
It has been, actually. I've been a lecturer at Belmont University for the last 5 years in the songwriting department.
Okay.
And I think it's actually a really good thing for some people. You know, for people who feel like they really want to get a more technical introduction into the world of songwriting, or for people who feel like, for young people who are 18, 19 years old, feel like they can write songs and they're interested in that, but they want to get a broader overview of that and not just be stuck with their own voice in their head in a little small town somewhere. I think it's a really good thing. I think it's a really good thing to do it here in Nashville, where you have so much great infrastructure of the music business around you. And so I actually think that for some people, this is going to a school like, or going to a program like ours at Belmont is a really good thing. I certainly am not saying that everybody should do that. Not everybody needs to, not everybody wants to, not everybody should want to do that.
Right. You've, over the course of your career, have been able to have other artists. You've written songs for people that have gone on to be hit songs in bluegrass world and that kind of thing. I know this might be kind of a tricky question, but if there is an answer, what's the difference between what makes it a good song? What makes it a hit song? What makes it a song that an artist will gravitate to, and then a listener will go, "I love that song." You know, there's so many songwriters, and there's good songs and there's not good songs. Is there a formula? How what makes a good song? Is there an answer to that question?
Well, I definitely think there is an answer to that question. I think you have to look at it by genre to some extent. And so if I try to write something for myself, that's a completely different approach than if I try to write something for somebody else. Especially if you co-write a lot, which I do, and which a lot of songwriters in Nashville do. Not everything that you write will end up being for you. And so you go into those co-writing sessions with that in mind. And if somebody has an idea that you think is strong but not for you, you put the same amount of energy and enthusiasm into it because you want to get that song cut.
Right.
I wouldn't call it a mistake, but a lot of songwriters end up not getting their songs cut because they don't write them with that intent. They write them specifically for themselves.
Mm.
So that's the first hurdle if you perceive it as one.
Mm-hmm.
The second most important thing to get a song cut is it needs to be relatable. So if you're just writing about your inner world, it's probably not going to be relatable to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you're a very, very, very gifted writer, I mean, people like Townsend Van Gogh about nothing else than their inner life, and a lot of people are influenced by it.
Right,
but
sure.
There's also a lot of songwriters who do that who nobody's ever heard of.
Right.
So I think, especially when you're writing for the bluegrass genre, which I do a lot because I just happen to love that kind of music,
uh-huh.
You need to have a good knowledge of the material that already exists. You need to have an understanding of the vocabulary that's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have understanding of stories that are interesting in that world, and how those stories have already been told, and if you can tell them in a different way.
Right.
You need to do your own research and fall in love with this part of the world and its people, because that's basically what you're going to write about.
Right.
And I think if you do that, then you'll find so much material that you can write about that, at least I do, that I've never come short of ideas or anything. And then once you develop a little bit of a reputation as a songwriter and develop relationships with artists, and they've had some success with your songs, they will come back
and go, of course.
Hey, this has worked well for us in the past. What do you have?
Okay.
So some people you end up sending 2 songs, and some people you end up sending 15 songs because you know that they enjoy listening to you.
Yeah.
And so it's a very slow process. So you have to have, you have to be in it for the long haul. If you expect to get stuff cut in the first year you're doing it, it's probably not going to happen.
Uh-huh. Do you have a process is it organic, or do you have a set time, daily, weekly kind of thing that you sit down and focus on songwriting, the craft of it?
Well, I would put it 2 ways. The first way I put it is I never stop writing.
Okay.
So when I'm running, when I'm cooking, when I'm cleaning the house, when I'm driving,
okay,
I'm always in, my mind is always to some degree involved in the world of songwriting. And second, like I said, I co-write a lot. So because of the nature of co-writing, you have to be structured about it, meaning you have to schedule it. So I typically have between 3 and 5 co-writing appointments a week.
That
holds you accountable to
coming
up with ideas and showing up on time and being open and being professional about it. And I don't write with a whole lot of different people. That's probably boiled down to, I'd say, maybe between 6 and 10 people that I write with all the time, but it's a pretty tight-knit group, and once you've done that for a while, it's a pretty magical process, because it's almost like you finish each other's sentences if you have a good idea.
Yeah, okay.
And so you also develop a sense for, this idea would be a good one to write with Jim Stafford, this idea would be a good one to write with Tammy Rogers, this idea would be a good one for Charlie Stephan, you know, so you think a little differently about it, I think. I do.
When you're writing for a particular artist or recording act, do you, if someone contacts you and says, "Hey, can you put a couple songs together for us?" How much research do you have to do into the type of person that they might be, their type of lifestyle, the type of music that particular band might play, or what type of region, the country they might be from? Do those things come into play?
Yes, but I will say this. So the process is not that somebody gets in touch with me and says, "Hey, do you have a couple songs for us?" And then you sit down and write the song. I already have the song.
Okay.
And then I go to my catalog, which is probably 500-600 songs, and look for what might be appropriate. But yes, to the other part of your question, very much so. I do my homework. I listen to their records, I listen to the range of the vocalists, I listen to the themes that they've been singing about, I listen to the songs that have been successful for them. Certain acts, I know what kind of chord progressions they gravitate towards. Some people, I know what thematically they want to sing about.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, so again, I'm not writing the song specifically for that person, although I could and I would if somebody would ask me to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But typically, somebody gets in touch with you, and you browse your catalog and find the stuff that you think is going to work. And,
okay. Yeah.
You know, you send people between 5 and 10 songs or whatever you're going to send them, and you make sure that tell them if none of these work, let me know. I'll send you some more.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
That's an important part of the pitching process.
Uh-huh, You mentioned that the record part 1 and 2, which I believe the name is Live in Two Worlds, correctly, and then it's Volume 1 and Volume 2. Yeah.
It's To Live in Two Worlds.
Yeah, To Live in Two Worlds. The songs that are on those two different projects, did you write them specifically for that? You mentioned earlier that you have songs that you feel like fit for you more than other people. Are these songs that you had in the catalog, or did you write specifically for this project?
No, they're all songs that I had in my catalog. But I knew, with some of them, I knew that if I'm not going to sing them, nobody else is going to record them because they're because they're a little too, just maybe too personal or too coming out of left field for a lot of people. So with some, I had a pretty good understanding when I wrote them. Every once in a while, I write a song with somebody and go like, "Yeah, I know nobody's going to record that, but I would."
Yeah. Okay.
So it was a mix of that and the fact that I'm always drawn to singing about characters from history or historical events more than I'm interested in singing about myself. I am in all those songs as an observer, and my emotions are in those songs, but the songs are not about me.
Right. Okay.
I would find that very claustrophobic if I'd write about myself all the time. So I very much prefer to write about other people and look at their lives through my lens.
Uh-huh.
That seems to be just more of a preference. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with doing it differently, but that's just the way I like
to do it. Yeah. Where did the title come from, To Live in Two Worlds?
The title comes from, it's a line in a song called Calling Me Home on Volume 1. And the whole line is, To Live in Two Worlds is all that we know, and I feel your love and it's calling me home. I wrote that with Tammy Rogers, who's in the Steel Drivers.
Yeah.
She's been on the road all her life, and I've been on the road till March 15th. All my life. And so it's a song about being grateful that you have a home to go back to, but you also have to go away to appreciate that. And it sounds pretty simple, and it's a simple song to me, and I like to use that word in a very, I hope, in a respectful way. But anyway, the title refers to me in many different ways, because I wasn't born here, but I was fascinated with country music and bluegrass music since I was 11 years old. And so I've lived my life in that part of the world and in this part of the world. I studied classical guitar in university, so I lived my life in part of my life in the world of classical music, and then now this part of my life in the world of American roots music.
Right.
And like I said, I write a lot about historical events, so I live in the here and now, but I also, in my mind, I spend a lot of time in between 1865 and 1925.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that, the title refers to all of those things.
Yeah. Okay. That's cool. You mentioned that one part of it's acoustic, the other part of it is with the band. When you finally get to go back out and present this music live, which way will you go? Have you decided yet, or will you do both?
Well, you know, it's a bluegrass band, so it's a traditional 5-piece bluegrass band, and it would not be feasible for me at this point to take a band like that on the road. Plus, the people that are on the record are some of the finest players in that world. It's Mark Fain on bass, who worked with everybody from Bruce Hornsby to Ry Cooder and Richard Jackson.
Yeah.
Mike Compton, who's a legendary mandolin player, who's the guy who played on the Old Brother Rarside soundtrack,
mm-hmm.
the National Bluegrass Band, and John Hartford, and then Tammy Rogers is playing fiddle, who's in the Steel Drivers, and Justin Moses is the banjo player, who's incredibly in demand, multi-instrumentalist. So it would be very difficult to find just one date to get those people.
Right, that would be a fun band, though, wouldn't it?
Well, you know, we had a date in May for a CD release at the Station Inn, where miraculously everybody would have been in town.
Yeah.
But obviously it's canceled. But I also feel like I feel in a pretty good spot musically and as a singer and as a performer to take these things to the world in a solo acoustic setting. And
yeah.
I've never I feel very confident in that setting for the first time in my life. I've always been more as a sideman, obviously, or played in a band context or in a duo context. But now I'm actually excited about doing stuff solo when it's possible again. And I certainly don't think that anything's going to happen before anything of any significance before summer of 2021.
Yeah, that's what everybody says, and it's nice to have a date, but it's unfortunate that we still have to wait so long. But
And it's impossible to plan for it, because you can't plan for you can't plan around a moving target.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Have you been able to do some virtual performing, like some artists?
Yeah, I've done a bunch of live streams, and it's been good, and it's been helpful in promoting these records. And it's fun. It's its own type of thing. It sort of feels like performing. Obviously, it is performing into a void, you know, because you have no feedback.
Right.
Or you have some feedback, but it's on a tiny screen in front of you. And, you know, I've played music for a living since I was 18 years old. I'm 50 now, so this is the longest I've gone without playing a gig in 32 years.
Wow.
So that's a strange, strange feeling to me. Although, you know, I'm okay. I'm not sad about not being in airports. I'm not
right.
looking for people's applause, but I miss being in front of people and the energy that's in an audience when you perform. That's what I miss, and it makes you play differently when you're in front of people. You play differently than when you're playing in front of a screen. You know?
Sure, it's a give and take. Yeah, yeah,
absolutely.
So, if folks would like to check these out, get a copy, check out some of your other music, look at maybe catch you on a live stream, what's the best way to get in touch and to pick up some of your CDs?
Well, the best way to follow the live stream stuff and all that is to follow me on social media, on Instagram or on Facebook, and or to go to my website, which is tomjutz.com, and that's TOMMJUTZ.com. And the records are on Spotify, they're on iTunes, you can get them through Mountain Home Music Company. I encourage people to stream, to buy, to do whatever they want to do. Music is available everywhere right now, and I don't intend to fight new technology by insisting on only selling my music.
Yeah,
TV.
Right, yeah, yeah. Well, thank you, Tom. I appreciate it. I've enjoyed listening to the some of the tracks on the record, and I certainly wish you well with the project.
Well, thank you very much. It's been good to talk to you.
Thanks again for tuning in to this episode of Americana Music Profiles. Find us on iTunes at Americana Music Profiles and on the internet at AmericanaRhythm.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frenino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.